All right, everybody. Hello, Sandow Podcast number 64. 64 episodes since we started this thing back in May, June of last year. Since then, we have been on a journey to understand DAOs, and that led us to foundation companies. Here we are on part 6 of our foundation company mini-series. We have a return guest with us, Carolyn from Walkers Global. Back in episode 59, it was Carolyn and Melissa. And Carolyn, you're an associate with Walkers Global, whereas Mel is a partner, correct?
I'm actually an associate at Walkers, and thanks for having me on again, Lance. I'm so glad to have been invited back to the show and sort of happy to be as helpful as possibly can in answering any questions you have.
Yeah, thank you. Very, very happy to have you back on. From last time, we had to cut it off right at the hour mark, and there were so many questions left. I was able to answer quite a few, I think, on some subsequent episodes since then, but there's still some really, really burning questions I have that I think will close this out really nicely. So the scope of the talk for today is another analysis of the facts, Q&A with a practicing attorney over in Grand Cayman Islands, who is actually very experienced with foundation companies, as was Mel. And it's all about transparency, trying to give our community and others more information to make smart decisions as we DAO. Disclaimer is neither of us represent the Sandbox Game or the Sandbox Foundation. We're not your financial or legal advisors, and nothing we say is to be taken as financial or legal advice. True for me, Carolyn. Still true for you?
Very true for me, Lance.
Very true. All right. So when we say the word SIP, AIP, or anything of that sort, we're talking about an improvement proposal for the DAO. When we say DAO, we mean a centralized autonomous organization. And if I ever use the word SANFAM, we're talking about the Sandbox community, those who participate in the people, product, and purpose of the Sandbox ecosystem. That ecosystem looks a little bit like this, where you have people, everywhere from gamers to the Sandbox team. The product is everything from the game client to the DAO. And the purpose is what is established on the white paper, as well as what's been expanded upon by the leadership of the Sandbox ecosystem, mostly Sebastian Bourget and Arthur Madrid. And the ecosystem lets everything go round and round. Today is episode 64, and we are squarely on the DAO. Today, we have Carolyn. She's coming, a return guest from episode 59 from Walkers Global. Again, Carolyn, if you wouldn't mind reintroducing yourself and...
Absolutely. Thanks, Lance. Yeah, no, I'm an associate in the fintech team at Walkers. I have a vast amount of experience working with Cayman Foundation companies and providing, which provides sort of the legal wrapper for the DAO. I've worked on sort of with, you know, the startup entities in this space, very notable names in the space, global regulated cryptocurrency exchanges, have advised, multiples of tens of these types of entities. So incredibly familiar. Walkers is the biggest off-chain offshore law firm providing services to DAOs foundation companies in this area. We have a really great regulatory team as well as on the fintech side. And so we have a real depth and breadth of expertise that we can offer to clients in this space. And it's led by the wonderful Melissa Lim and Lucy Frew at Walkers.
Yeah, as we did cover in a previous episode, Walkers is highly experienced. If you looked at the solutions, looked at the R people, locations that they have, and we went over the article that eventually led me to Mel and Carolyn from episode 59. So extremely experienced, and as you can see, Carolyn is very familiar with foundation companies. Hence, episode 64. We'll do a very, very brief recap. I slimmed it down quite a bit, and then we'll jump right in that Q&A. So that recap started with episode 34, moved on, which was a look into the DAO origins for the Sandbox. Episode 56 was a reading of the Cayman Islands Law. I read through everything from the Companies Management Act to the Companies Act to the Foundation Companies Act and more. And then 57, we had a U.S. practicing attorney on where we talked about DAOs and case law, particularly the case law over happening in California. Episode 59, we had Mel and Carolyn on talking, briefing foundation companies from a Cayman Islands lawyer perspective. And episode 60 was part four, and that was a reading of all the Sandbox DAO Foundation documents, particularly the Constitution, which is made up of the Articles of Association and the Memorandum of Association, as well as the bylaws. And then episode 62, part five, was a reading of Star Atlas style documents and their constitution. So that leads us to today, episode 64, which is a Q&A, and there were all the burning questions that I had and received from others about foundation companies. We will get answered today. And yeah, so that relationship map in episode 34 is what kicked it all off, trying to figure out what was going on, who was doing what, and so much of this now makes so much more sense. We'll do a wrap-up episode in a future episode to kind of bring it all together. Then we did in episode 56, that law regulation stack, where the Companies Act I mentioned, foundation company law, and others. It gave a lot of meaning to all these things that we were looking at. What is an article association? What is a foundation? What does it mean to be limited by guarantee? Why do we see the words Cayman Islands Monetary Authority? Why is there a $50 duty stamp on it? So all these sorts of things had a lot of meaning given to it after we read the regulations. And then in episode 57, we went over some court rulings that are applicable to DAOs right now, Aoki DAO, BZX, Lido, and others. And then that led us to, throughout the course of that, an article that I was reading penned by none other than Mel and Carolyn and Walkers Global called Cayman Island Foundation Companies Are a Leading Vehicle for Wrapping a DAO. That led us to episode 59, where Mel and Carolyn gave us a rundown of foundation companies, DAOs, and virtual assets, going over things such as why would a DAO form a Cayman foundation company? What are the timeline events that lead from the inception of a foundation company to a director-led to a token holder-led? I didn't know anything about that until they said that. So that was huge, huge education for me. And then what documents are required to form a foundation company, as well as many other things. Check that out in episode 59. We left with TLDR, which I began in episode 34, and I've been updating ever since. What is a foundation company? Right now I have is both the name of the Sandbox DAO and a type of company in the Cayman Islands. It's also flexible in how it's structured and operates. What is an exempted company? It means a company that does business outside the Cayman Islands. Limited by guarantee means the members of the foundation can only lose what they put into the company. Without any share capital means no shares, otherwise known as units of ownership, were created when the company was formed. Articles and Memorandum of Association. The memo seems to be the thing that creates the foundation company. The articles describes how it will be operated, kind of like your business rules. And bylaws establish internal business rules, which are optional if you are dealing with a foundation company. Not optional if you're in the foundation company. I'm sure Carolyn will correct me on that one. Lots of business is done in the Cayman Islands. 1,000 companies alone were registered in the Cayman Islands. 1,000 alone, with about 120 active since late 2024. Foundation rules are flexible and varied. Subscriber seems to be the one that creates the foundation company. Secretary seems to be one that's licensed by SEMA, the monetary authority, to document, record, certify other activities. Director leads the foundation company, and the members, founders, officers, supervisors, managers, they all conduct daily activities in accordance with their role. All this is governed by the Grand Cayman Island Law, namely the Companies Act and the Foundation Company Act. We're going to start our Q&A, and the very first thing we're going to ask Carolyn is anything I just said incorrect, Carolyn? Do I need to fix anything on that TLDR?
Thank you. I think broadly that was correct. I mean, maybe just to provide a little bit more clarity. So when we talk about bylaws and how that interacts with the M&A, it really depends, which is a very legal answer. But the bylaws typically set out token holder governance, and then the memorandum and articles of association, the foundation company, are updated to reflect that token holder governance, so thereby creating this sort of link between the two documents. And it's those two documents combined that provides the legal wrapper for a DAO. So maybe just that's like clarificatory point that it's token holder governance. They are optional, of course. If the intention is that there is not going to be token holder governance, then bylaws do not need to be implemented. We've also seen it where there's a DAO, but the DAO provides ad hoc instructions to the foundation company, and so those governance mechanics are not set out in bylaws. So there's also that consideration as well. And then
now I get that. That's why the director led the token holder letter the way it was on that slide. So the token holder led is initiated with the bylaws.
That's the document that sets out the governance. Okay, so that will be the document that where you see all the kind of voting proposal, how proposals can be made, voting thresholds, through what channels, who has the right to vote on that. You know, sets out the sort of quorum and voting process and voting. You know, the sort of thresholds for voting as well in terms of when a proposal will be passed and then implemented, and then the foundation company and the directors of the foundation company will implement the token holder governance votes that have been passed, and the director or directors, in accordance with the memorandum and articles of association, have to act in compliance with the articles and also the bylaws. And so say for if you know, any sort of token holder voters ask the directors to do anything that's illegal, contrary to Cayman law, then obviously the directors have the ability to not follow it. But save for that, they must follow, act in accordance with the bylaws and the articles. And so if a token holder vote has passed and that's been set out in the bylaws, then the directors will enact the will of the DAO. So the foundation company itself, obviously represented by its directors, will enact the will of the DAO. In those circumstances.
Got it. I don't think I understood that nuance. When you first talked about that, it kind of went over my head, like token holder, what's the trigger now? Okay.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
we're getting into the thing that's been on my mind ever since I started this. And we need to tear this apart. Okay. What is the relationship between the DAO and the foundation company? Talk about separate legal entities, personalities. Can you spell that out for me, please?
Yeah. So I think probably the best explanation is that the interaction between a DAO and its foundation company is a blend of sort of decentralized governance and centralized legal execution. So the DAO will make decisions through kind of on-chain voting. That might be sort of budget allocations, grants, improvements to the network. The foundation company, because it's a legal entity, implements those decisions in the real world. So signing contracts, transferring the fiat funds, or sort of filing legal documents. Now, that's because the DAO is not in and of itself a legal entity. And so the foundation company acts as the legal entity on behalf of the DAO in that particular respect. So what you'd have is, you have these community members, as I've said, to kind of submit proposals. And that might be to hire a developer or fund an event. And then if approved, the foundation company is the one that might process those payments, sign those agreements, perform the necessary legal actions on behalf of the DAO. And then the foundation is there to also ensure that the DAO activities comply with the regulations. So, in Cayman, is it acting in accordance with the law in terms of the virtual asset service providers legislation, particularly KYC, AML? And so it may reject or modify any proposals if those pose any legal risks. And hopefully often they're doing that with community transparency. And so it's basically they're there to manage kind of the off-chain assets as instructed by DAO governance, enter into those, the foundation is to enter into contracts with third parties to carry out the kind of DAO approved work. And, you know, I think in DAO and foundation companies that operate really, really well, you know, the foundation court says transparency between the two, and the foundation reports to the DAO, provides updates on legal and financial and operational matters. Mm. And transparency is that key to maintaining that community trust and decentralization. But effectively, you know, we also spoke about the shield of liability that the foundation company may provide to the DAO. And that article of mine that you read, Lance, touched upon that, because the idea is that if an action is brought against, you know, there is a litigious claim, for example, that the foundation company would absorb that claim as opposed to the DAO members in and of themselves, provided that it's the foundation company that is entering into, for example, a contract that becomes litigious. It wouldn't be the individual DAO members, is the sort of theory behind the shield of liability point that the foundation company can provide to the DAO. I think that's kind of a good summation of the interaction between the two.
Okay. And we're getting some touchy subjects, but it needs to be asked. What is the legal authority that the foundation company has over the DAO, if any?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's. Yeah, conceptually, it's not really the way it works. You know, you have a DAO that will pass community governance proposals, and then the foundation company implements those. The foundation company and the directors of that foundation company, the directors of the foundation company need to act in the kind of the best interest of the company. And so if the DAO members propose something that gets passed, that the directors, you know, that's, for example, contrary to Cayman law or in breach of one of their duties, the directors have the ability to reject that proposal, but otherwise must act in compliance with the bylaws and the articles. So it's not so much what legal authority does the foundation company have over the DAO as it is, how can the DAO influence the foundation company? And I think you've mentioned like SIPs, you know, the improvement proposal process, and that, all of that, like SIPs and improvement, any sort of improvement proposal process will be set out in the bylaws. So it's a really important document. And that kind of sets the tone for the relationship between the two and provides the authority, if you like, for the DAO to instruct a foundation company to carry out the will of the DAO.
Okay. I'm writing that down because that's going to become important for us later. I've been in DAOing now as a verb since May, and I've been DAOing near full time. It's like a second job to me now. I'm enjoying myself thoroughly in the process. What I've learned is that in the execution of its responsibilities, I have observed foundation companies, and not disparaging, just my observation, I have observed foundation companies exercise a degree of authority over the DAO in different situations, such as a foundation company director, let's say, would appoint someone to a DAO position. Or in your case, you mentioned a foundation company officer or director would alter the voting results of a DAO. And when I say alter, I mean change parts of the proposal that it did not believe was executable. So I think that falls squarely within what you're saying earlier. But I've noticed other situations that don't fit neatly within the if it's AML or if it's illegal, immoral, unethical, that sort of thing. It's more of like, I don't even know what it is, procedural? Do you get what I'm getting at? Are you?
It's difficult to comment without knowing the kind of the context of what we're talking about here. But I suppose, you know, the directors, one of the, you know, non-executive independent directors are there to provide independent oversight. And will highlight risk. That's part of their job, is to highlight risk and act in accordance with the best corporate governance procedures. And okay. So if there is something that the directors perceive as a risk to the foundation company, because, you know, ultimately the directors have to act in the best interests of the foundation company, they have fiduciary obligations, sort of, you know, a duty to disclose any conflicts, for example. And so if there is something that the directors see, perceive as a threat to that, then they are within their rights to highlight that risk appropriately. And if that risk, you know, is if that risk is something where it is, you know, illegal or against their primary obligations to the foundation company, then they have the ability to refuse to, or certainly to maybe adapt it so that it conforms to the required standard before they implement it.
Okay. In situations where there's no legal issue at play, there's no money laundering at risk, let's just say that the special counsel is elected and one of them is moral disrepute. Moral turpitude, maybe is the word, but it's not spelled out in the bylaws that that is a thing. The director believes, regardless of whether or not the bylaws specify that as a reason to remove someone, decides to remove that council member anyways. What would you say? How would you classify that?
I think, you know, they have the authority to act in the best interests of the company. And if you have a council member that does not, is in, you know, it's called disrepute to the foundation company, then they potentially would have, you know, they would certainly be raising questions about that. And I would imagine that the bylaws would have mechanics for, I mean, I've reviewed and commented upon many bylaws where there is a process for removing special counsel members. And so to the extent that that process is followed, you know, I think that would be within their remit of their authority.
So it sounds as though the directors, regardless of kind of how the bylaws are structured, because the director has that fiduciary responsibility and they're the overall person responsible for the company, they kind of have that ultimate authority to do what's in the best interest of the foundation company, regardless of what the bylaws say.
I mean, their primary duty is to act in the best interest of the company, but it's not. And, you know, I think if that is at odds with a proposal that is being passed, or there is something like in your example where there's a special council member who's been brought into disrepute, then the fact, you know, the directors can would need to look at that very closely and to determine whether or not that's in the best interest of the foundation company. But they also have to be cognizant of the fact that if a proposal has been passed and the bylaws set something out, then it's not so much that one kind of trumps the other. They need to sort of view it in side by side. But in essence, you know, their duty and their obligation is to the foundation company to ensure that they are making the right decisions for the foundation. It's not for the DAO. The DAO in and of itself is, it's slightly separate, but you know, you create this nexus through the bylaws with the foundation company to so that, you know, the foundation company enacts the will of the DAO to the extent that it is not, you know, contrary to Cayman law, or that it's not in the you know, the directors are not in breach of any of their duties.
All right, I need to crystallize that, because that to me is the period right there. As long as it's not in contrary to Cayman Island law or in breach of their duties, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. I think that settles it right there. There is a difference. That difference does take on significant meaning should there be any divergence between what the DAO recommends or votes, and the foundation company or the director decides within all due bounds that this is not within the best interest of the foundation company. But to use that power would you say, sparingly, and to ensure that it's still, they act within the will of the bylaws and the DAO, and to the extent that they can.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
I think that's the best way to look at it.
Excellent. Cool. I think this is coming together very nicely. All right. Let's get some technics down. This one has been plaguing me for a while. I've been trying to figure it out. Are the DAO token holders considered members or beneficiaries of the foundation company?
No.
Okay.
They're not.
Can you tell me more about that, especially the beneficiaries part?
Beneficiaries, you don't have to designate beneficiaries of a foundation company, but you can. And I think we maybe touched upon this when we spoke at the beginning, and because of the way in which the concept of foundation companies came to fruition. But if you think about how the foundation company is set up with where it's limited by guarantee and it has the characteristics of a civil law foundation. And so civil law foundations were used for succession planning and philanthropic purposes. Foundations were not available in the Cayman Islands. Therefore, we had civil law clients who required to use more traditional common law trust structures. And so the concept of a trust, it's quite important to understand beneficiaries, although is quite flexible and reliable in succession planning tools, it's less attractive to many civil law clients. And so two of the main reasons for that was the unfamiliarity with the separation of the legal and the beneficial interests and the uncertainty as to kind of the tax treatment. So there was lots of, offshore jurisdictions who then wanted to establish common law or offshore foundations by statute. However, the difficulty with that approach is that offshore foundations is kind of statutory constructs with no established body of jurisprudence. So this has resulted in considerable uncertainty.
Okay.
So the Cayman Island solution to this was to establish a hybrid that looks like a civil law foundation, but benefits from long established jurisprudence, which relates to companies. And so what you have is you can have in the articles of association provisions which include having beneficiaries, but it's not a requirement that Cayman foundations have beneficiaries. Details of if you did appoint beneficiaries, they would, they're set out in the bylaws or otherwise. And unless otherwise provided in the memorandum of association, the beneficiary has no power or rights relating to the foundation company if one is in fact instituted, and its management or and its assets, and it's not considered to be an interest in person as defined in the Act. It's not really relevant for the types of clients we work with. And I don't know whether the sandbox DAO, do you guys have, I've not seen your constitutional documents. I don't know whether you guys would, foundation company has beneficiaries or not, but typically we don't often see that, but it can.
That was one of my questions is who, because they weren't specifically identified, but there is a role for it.
Oh, right. In your articles, is that what you're saying?
Right. Yes. That's right.
Right. Okay.
So that was my question to, TTA and the DAO admin team is who are the beneficiaries? I'm trying to understand who fulfills those roles. And
they benefit from the foundation's purpose, right? They are,
right.
They should be explicitly named really in the constitutional documents. But it could be like classes of persons, but it potentially depends on, it's difficult to say without looking at the documents and knowing, but effectively, yeah, they, and members, I think we discussed before, obviously a foundation company is incorporated with a subscriber who guarantees to contribute the amount on a winding up, which I think is, typically like a dollar in the memorandum and articles of association.
Yeah, all of them say a dollar.
Yeah, they're a dollar, right? But then on incorporation, that member resigns, and the foundation company is left as a shareholderless, memberless entity moving forward.
No, keep going, please.
And then the DAO token holders, obviously, we're talking about the community there, right? Right. So that is separate from the foundation company. The way in which the nexus between the foundation company and the DAO token holders is established is through the bylaws and the articles being amended to conform to the token holder governance mechanics as set out in the bylaws.
Got it. I want to pose I won't say a hypothetical. I'm going to pose a situation. I'm trying to peel this apart a little bit. Let's say there becomes a unmitigatable conflict between the token holders. I'm not saying this is real. Let's just bring this to where it's going to be sometime in the future. Someone's going to trip over this. When the token holders are at odds with the leadership of the foundation company, what recourse do they have to correct things as they see fit? Let's call it. Do they have any recourse?
That is probably a question that requires actual legal advice.
Okay.
Because right, it's a bit tricky because we've got client, you know, I wouldn't want to speak out of turn on.
Sure, and I wouldn't want you to either.
Going through this process at the moment, but I totally understand why the question is being asked.
Yeah, and it's just a matter of at this point trying to understand these entities, like what is if they're not beneficiaries, but they are the ones who execute a vote on everything, and they're the engine behind it. What happens if there is a conflict? Is there an amicable way to resolve that? Those are the things that are running through my head, just as a natural thought, thinking through this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just important to know that, you know, DAO token holders are not, you know, not the members, not the shareholders, beneficiaries or directors of the foundation company. Mm-hmm. The Cayman Islands Foundation Company is managed by its board of directors who have the legal authority. But if the foundation company operates under its charter and bylaws, that's DAO governance. And so the foundation company is there to, like I said, enact the will of the DAO. So community token holder voting happens, and then as a result of that, the foundation company enacts the will of the DAO. There isn't really a authority that is established other than the directors have to act in compliance with the articles. And so if the articles say that it's token holder voting on a particular topic, for example, the token holders by way of token holder vote have the ability to appoint and remove the supervisor, then the directors mm-hmm. cannot just go ahead and remove the supervisor by way of director resolution. It has to go to a token holder vote. So it can be enforced, you know, there is this link between the two. And if the directors act in non-compliance with the memorandum and articles of association, then the supervisor may bring enforcement action against the directors for breach of those, basically, and saying, hey, you didn't act in compliance with a token holder vote which said we wanted to remove the supervisor, and you know that would then follow on, you know, that the process would then follow on because the supervisor has the ability to take the directors to court on behalf of the foundation company for those types of breaches. So there is that mechanic in play where you have a sort of a supervisor which is like the enforcer and counterbalances that director authority.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
But there should be that clear drafting in the articles to reflect token holder governance, because then, you know, it's pretty easy then you've got something to point to say, hey, you didn't comply. And in the articles, it says that you this is the process you should have followed. And you are also under an obligation to comply with the articles of association. And you didn't in this instance. And therefore, the supervisor may take an action against the directors for that.
Got it. When we mentioned the director as a fiduciary, what is he or she a fiduciary of?
It's at the foundation.
Okay, so my brain thought about parsing out the objects, the members, all sorts of classes. Is that just an unnecessary distinction, or is it just foundation company? No other distinction need be made.
Sorry, Lance, just say that again.
My brain was parsing that out as, is there such a thing as it's fiduciary of the objects? It's fiduciary of the members? Is that distinction unfit?
Okay, yeah, no, I see what you're saying. So the directors of a Cayman Foundation company have fiduciary duties to the foundation company itself, and the foundation's stated purpose are set out in the memorandum. They do not have responsibilities and fiduciary obligations to the share to token holders, members, beneficiaries. It's to the foundation company itself, and you know, duty of loyalty, duty to act in with reasonable skill, care and diligence, duty to act within its powers, which is the, you know, the objects in the memorandum, duty to avoid conflicts of interest, but they do not owe fiduciary duties to the DAO token holders directly. Their primary obligation is to carry out the foundation's mission, which often includes supporting a DAO or protocol, obviously.
Sure.
And then if the governance process, as I mentioned, is set out in the Articles of Association, the directors have a duty to consider those DAO votes, and is under an obligation to follow them through, say, for if it's, you know, contrary to Cayman law or is clearly not in the best interest of the company.
Yeah, I'm starting to hear the same. You're saying some of the same things, and it's starting to connect now, at least for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's, you know, this is intricate, complex inner workings of how this all interacts. So, you know, it requires repetition, and in order to understand, you know, I've been doing this for sort of a few years now. So I've got the hang of it myself, but I appreciate looking in from the outside. It's all a bit bamboozling.
Yeah, I think it took me reading every page of the the foundation company's law and the company's
Act. Well done, you.
For me to, well, yeah, I had to do it for my professional job. So it was just another set of body of regulations, but it got dense. It got, especially in the latter portions about the court, the remediation, all of that. I think it took that. That's why I was so interested in you all coming on, is to give some practicality to what am I reading?
Yeah, totally get it. I mean, that's our job, right?
Yeah.
We know the law, we distill it, and we can provide advice on particular areas. So yeah, I'm happy to help.
In Section 7 of the Foundation's Company Law, I'm referencing Part 3, Section 7, it said the foundation company has a duty to carry out the objects set out in its memo if and only if the memo declares and designates persons with standing to enforce the duty against the foundation company. That read to me like the foundation company has a choice in carrying out its objects. Am I misreading that?
Sections, I mean, the way the objects work is that it sets out a scope, right? So it's saying that the foundation, you know, I mean, I'm just going to see if I can pull up, you know, just.
I can copy paste it in the chat as well, if that helps.
Oh, that's useful. But yeah, I mean, the broad sort of, you want to have like a broad and flexible scope, but it might be that it's, you know, its objects are to assist with the growth and support the development of a certain, you know, insert decentralized network. And so really we sort of suggest that they are quite broad, because you don't want their directors or the foundation company to do something that's outside of its objects. We make those pretty broad, but and the directors, you know, must act in compliance with the objects.
Yeah. Okay. I think we brought it all full circle there. Okay. And the founder role seems optional. Okay, let me say seems. It's in the template of the foundation company law, and it's not mentioned anywhere else.
Yeah, it's
Sandbox has a founder's role. Star Atlas does not. I'm unsure about ApeCoin because I haven't been able to get. I can't find their documents anywhere, so I'm not sure what their stance is on that. What are your thoughts on the founder's role?
The way we do it, you know, the way we operate at Walkers is that we have a memorandum and articles of association that are director led. So the powers vest with the directors, but you can have a situation where the founder, you have a founder position where they play sort of a crucial role in the ongoing control or ongoing governance of the foundation, akin to, akin to a director. I've seen articles where they have the founder concept built into it, and it sets out the founder's rights and the founder rights, and they can be pretty extensive. I haven't seen
sandboxes.
Sandbox is pretty extensive.
It seems like they have near dictator powers, and it's extraordinary how much power that the founder has to remove and appoint many, many positions. I think even the director.
Yeah. And I think typically this probably came around because you have like the founders of these projects and then wanting to retain control. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you're looking at decentralized token holder governance, then our view is that you have the we would set it up with like initial bylaws just to get the memorandum and articles of association to get the foundation company incorporated and stood on its feet pretty quickly. And we vest there the authority with the directors. So you can do that with the founder, and then a later date you amend and restate the memorandum and articles of association to reflect the token holder governance. So then at that point the founder role kind of disappears because it's not required, and the token holder governance may take over some of those rights depending upon, you know, what the bylaws say. But you do have to have a directors. So that is not something that just falls by the wayside. You have to have a minimum of one director of a Cayman Islands Foundation company, but the founder role is not required by law. It's preference. And this is, you know, a testament to the flexibility of a Cayman Islands Foundation company and what can be done with their constitutional documents.
Is there something about the founder role that Walkers, or the very least in your view, it's just not suitable?
Not particularly. I think it's maybe driven by like what clients are seeking to do. So, you know, if you think about the decentralization ethos, having the rights and obligations sitting with one person or persons, but, you know, typically it might be a corporate entity or a particular person, is against the decentralization ethos. And so I think we've just seen that clients are not really looking for that structure. But, you know, it depends, because also if you think that, like, I don't know about your DAO, Land Sandbox DAO, but whether, you know, that the idea is that token holder governance is either in play or coming in shortly, it might just be, okay, well, quickly we'll get it incorporated. We'll use the standard documents. Yeah, it has founder powers in, but we know they're going to change because we're going to have bylaws which set out token holder governance. So when we amend and restate the memorandum and articles of association, it will have founder power.
Coming together. Our DAO leadership has frequently talked about progressive decentralization and the end goal being what I now know to be called token holder led. This must be the precursor to that then. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So,
okay.
And I've seen that. That's often the case. So progressive decentralization is incredibly popular. And, you know.
Do we have you to thank for that? Is that you and Mel?
No, it's client driven. I have to admit, it's what do you want? You know, we're saying to clients, if they have their like token holder governance sorted, right, if they're already coming to us and they've got a DAO, they've got tokens, and now they want a foundation company, then we might say, hey, well, you're all ready to go with your token holder governance, and you've got bylaws, then we can incorporate it with token holder governance from the outset. But most clients come to us where they're, you know, pre that level of sort of sophistication, and so would say, okay, well, we'll incorporate the foundation, and we just happen to do it where it's director led, so the authority and the power vests with the directors. But I've seen it where it's vests with the founders, but that will change when you amend and restate your articles if you have bylaws which set out token holder governance that are going to be implemented into the articles, so it will then reflect across the two documents.
Okay. And switching gears to the interaction between the roles, subscriber, director, secretary, supervisor, at the beginning of when a foundation company is contemplated, how do those roles play out with each other?
Sure. So maybe if we take the first role, so directors, I think probably is a good place to start. So there must be one director, and they do not have to be Cayman Islands resident, but lots of clients opt for that, given sort of tax position and interactions with the US, particularly, and having US people on the board. So they're similar to a traditional company. The business and affairs of the foundation will be managed by or under the control of those directors. As we said, we've spoken about vesting the powers with the directors initially. And they have that duty to act in the best interest of the foundation company. They must always act in accordance with the foundation's company's memorandum and articles of association, as well as any bylaws adopted by the foundation company from time to time. So there will always be a director from incorporation, basically.
And they're taken in first? They're the first ones to be identified?
Well, you have to have there's sort of three roles, right? So you've got to have a secretary who's licensed under the Companies Management Act in the Cayman Islands, and they typically provide the registered office for the foundation company. You can't incorporate without a secretary. You can't incorporate without directors. A foundation company doesn't have members, then a supervisor must be appointed. And as I kind of explained, like, we incorporate foundation companies so that they are memberless. And so a supervisor is also, in conjunction with the appointment of the directors and the secretary from incorporation. And so it all kind of happens together, Lance. Like, we've got documents where you see this interaction. The subscriber has to subscribe that it will pay that amount, that $1 amount that we discussed, if upon the winding up of the foundation company, and then their liability to pay that is extinguished once the foundation company is incorporated, and the subscriber appoints the directors and the secretary. But it all happens together. None of this comes together without those roles being in place. And so when we're incorporating, we will ask, okay, who have you decided are going to be your directors? Who's going to be your supervisor? Who's going to be your secretary? And then we draft all the documents. It's all reflected and it all happens on the same day.
And so the secretary must be licensed by SEMA. Does the director need to be licensed by SEMA? And I'm not talking about ones that are under the jurisdiction of Securities Investment Business Act and all of that, just the regular director.
I think Aviat Walkers is yes. I think, and then we've also, you've got the supervisor and the director can actually be the same person. And they have kind of the voting rights at general meetings, which are really, like, it's a non-thing really for foundation companies. They have the rights to access some of the accounts, the records or information of the foundation company, and they may bring an action in the name or on behalf of the foundation company, the enforcement of duties of the directors. So they have a really crucial role, but it's in the day-to-day running and operations of the foundation company. Their role is typically quite passive.
The supervisor you're referring to?
The supervisor.
Okay.
So you can make the supervisor have, like, greater rights and powers and set those out in the articles, but the way that we have seen this structure work and what we've worked on is that the supervisor role is a very passive role. But there are, like, they have sort of statutory there are things laid out in the Foundation Companies Act where, like, they have the right to access the accounts, records, and information of the foundation company. But it's a very, very passive role typically.
And the supervisor and director being the same person, there's no concern there of conflict?
Very good question. I think so. They have the right to bring action. Are they really going to bring it against themselves? But and we've seen the market evolve over time. It's not against the law for them to be the same person.
Okay.
It's set out in the Companies Act that they explicitly, they can be the same person. But we've seen the market evolve on this, and we're now often seeing foundation companies where you have that separation.
Got it. That makes sense. And so a director is licensed by SEMA, just as the secretary is?
They don't have to be licensed, but they, you know, our view is that the company, if they're providing directorship services, then they should have a company's management license. Again, the market has shifted on this over time, and now most service providers in the Cayman Islands will have the company's management license. I'm sort of hesitant is because there's like varying views on this. But that's typically where we've aligned ourselves. Okay. We want them to be providing those services through a regulated a body that has the company's management license.
Got it. As I was reading through all of the laws, I think that one was the most obscure to me, which is, does the director need to be licensed or not? And it seems like yes, when you've crossed this very obvious threshold, but then there's this area of what about them, those that are not in that area? And couldn't make heads or tails of it, but thank you. I appreciate that.
You're
varying
welcome.
Views. just briefly on the terminology, I found some terms that applied in one, didn't apply in others. They seem to be substituting words. Is that a big deal, or is there something meaning there that I'm missing?
The
terminology variation between all the acts.
The acts will have sort of clear definitions within them that set out what it is they're referring to. And if you think about the Foundation Companies Act, the act that applies to that should really be read in conjunction with that as the Companies Act. So that's crucially important. And then any kind of regulatory overlay, sort of the virtual asset service providers legislation, needs to be read in the context of a standalone statute. But the Foundation Companies and the Companies Act has an interplay, and the Foundation Company, so it incorporates the Companies Act, and then there are certain provisions which are carved out of the Companies Act. So if you looked at the Foundation Company Act, there's a schedule at the back, I'm just flicking through it myself, which says that these are excluded provisions from the Companies Act. And then modifications to specific provisions of the Companies Act for foundation companies. So it's quite interesting. And whenever I'm looking at a particular piece of law, you know, and I'm thinking about the Companies Act, I'll just flick to the back of here and just to make sure that actually is it excluded or is it a modified provision for the purposes of a foundation company, just to ensure that I'm covering, making sure that's, you know,
that,
whether that's
the nuance I missed. Got
I mean, have a look at it. It's in Schedule 1 of the Foundation Companies Act if you are interested.
Are
interested.
Schedule 1, I'm looking for excluded provisions. And what was the other term?
Modifications to certain provisions in the Companies Act that are applicable to foundation companies.
That is fascinating. Okay, I will take a look at that. And when I run across modifications to certain provisions applicable to the foundation company, how do I read that? It's not an excluded provision.
No, they're just modifying like certain parts of the Companies Act. So it will point you in the direction of, you know, like for example, one of the modifications in Section 89. There's like a definition where they've slightly tweaked it in the Foundation Companies Act. It's things like that where you would look at it and be like, oh, okay, they've changed it to mean this. And so then the Foundation Companies Act needs to be, that's why I said they need to be read in conjunction with one another, because it implements all of the Companies Act, save for any excluded provisions in the back or modifications to provisions in the Companies Act.
Okay.
So there's like a definite nexus and, you know, interplay between those two statutes.
Okay. No, that makes sense to me. Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. We are almost through all the questions. I loved that we just went right through that. The last one I had was the flow chart. But I think you may have answered quite a bit of that since it's done all at the same time.
It was difficult looking at this. I wanted to like maybe expand upon that slightly for your listeners. It's sort of difficult to have a flowchart in lots of ways because of how it kind of operates. But you've got the, you know, if we're in the context of like there is already a DAO in place, then yeah, you know, the DAO wants to have a legal wrapper, and so then they could definitely approach law firms and ask for sort of recommendation or go to different service providers. A selection of service providers prior to incorporation. So to fulfill those roles that we spoke about, which are, you know, the director role, supervisor role, and the secretary who provides the registered office role. Selecting legal providers, like all of that is, yeah, like, prior to incorporation. And then when we say the director provides corporate services, I think, you know, they provide director services. I guess it is a kind of corporate service, but to be more explicit.
I pulled that directly from the act itself. So I wasn't sure. The terminology thing I was discussing earlier.
Like that's like, obviously they form part of like the corporate services banner. On incorporation, you know, as part of the incorporation process, obviously you have the Memorandum and Articles of Association, which are those core constitutional documents that are drafted at the point of incorporation. So everything is drafted. You have the, you know, all of the requisite documents to appoint those service providers. You have the Memorandum and Articles of Association. And then, you know, that then is, and then the foundation company is incorporated and then has all of those roles fulfilled. And then optional bylaws, I would agree with that. Like bylaws, you don't have to have bylaws. And if there isn't token holder governance, then there wouldn't be any bylaws. Even if there is token holder governance, sometimes they don't have, you know, bylaws are not introduced, and the DAO provide kind of ad hoc instructions to the foundation company. It's not the way we do it at Walkers. So I can't really speak too much more on that. But typically, we've got token holder governance, it's set out, that governance process is set out fully in the bylaws.
Okay. So in the procession of things, a DAO, whether or not they're firmly formed or they have an idea of a DAO, they can do it in any order they'd like in terms of if they come to Walkers first or if they go to a director's management company first. It kind of all loops back around to itself in the end because you have to do everything all at once in terms of who's the director, who is the secretary.
And the thing is, like, if it comes to somebody in Cayman, the likelihood is, you know, it's going to hit a few different service providers. Well, it definitely will.
All in Georgetown.
in Georgetown. So it will be the case of, like, you know, it might go to Walkers or one of the other law firms initially. It might not. It might come from one of the directorship shops who's got a good relationship with somebody who's like, hey, I'm looking to set up a DAO. But it will filter across, you know, you will get these positions have to be fulfilled prior to incorporation. So, or certainly in conjunction with incorporation. So it will all sort of come to fruition once the foundation's incorporated.
Makes sense. I think it's all come together quite nicely now. And so, like you said, the market evolves. And I'm sure as different, I think in America, we call it case law. Do you call it something similarly? Where judgments are ruled and then the market will evolve based on judgments.
I mean, that's absolutely right. Yeah, we call it case law over here. It kind of operates in the same way as this common law jurisdiction. So we sort of follow the United Kingdom for sort of precedent and case law.
Got it. That is everything I wanted to go over in terms of on the prepared questions. Did you have anything that you wanted to go over? Any other topics you wanted to cover before we conclude?
No, I'm just delighted to be part of this, Lance, and thank you again for contacting me and letting me be part of this podcast and to talk about I think something I'm incredibly passionate about, which is foundation companies and DAO structures. And, you know, it's great to be at the forefront of it while it's still in its infancy.
It's certainly in its infancy in terms of a lot of the DAOers over here.
Yeah.
Just so many of us didn't even know what this was until like last year. I'd say it still hasn't hit mainstream, but the more DAOs are starting to take hold of Web3, and they're happening quite quickly. The familiarity with DAOs, foundation companies are like almost a paired word now. So great success when it comes to the Cayman Islands business framework being applied to DAOs. I think they almost go hand in hand.
Yeah,
almost.
I agree. It's been it's an incredible vehicle, really, and a vehicle of choice for people in this space and for DAOs, you know, for the reasons we've discussed on this podcast. So
yeah.
Long may it continue is all I can say from my perspective.
Long may it continue. Carolyn, thank you so much your time. I appreciate you giving us your expertise and not legal advice, but also your perspective and helping us try and piece this together. I think we have quite a clear picture now that we can draw from how foundation companies support DAOs.
Well, you're more than welcome anytime, Lance. And hopefully I'll see you again soon on another interesting topic on this podcast.
I'd love to. All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carolyn, and everyone else. Thank you.